From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It was kind of an open secret in the literary world that memoirist and literary critic Anatole Broillard was a black man passing for white. His daughter, Bliss Broillard, thought of herself as white. She didn't learn his secret until she was 24 and he was on his deathbed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bliss Broillard about her new memoir, One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, a story of race and family secrets. Also, an important story in the development of the global jihadi movement. We talk with journalist Yaroslav Trofimov about the 1979 siege of Mecca. He describes it as the first explosion of Sunni Islamist violence in the modern world and a prelude to Al-Qaeda's outrages. It's the subject of his new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the literary world, it was somewhere between a rumor and an open secret that the writer Anatole Breuer was a light-skinned black man passing for white. Breuer wrote a couple of terrific memoirs. Kafka Was the Rage was about living the bohemian life as a young man in Greenwich Village after World War II. Intoxicated by My Illness was about the end of his life when he was dying of prostate cancer. Breuer was also a longtime book critic and columnist for the New York Times. He kept his racial identity a secret from his two children. When he was dying, they knew he had a secret, but they didn't find out what it was until very close to the end when their mother told them. Anatole Breuer's daughter, Bliss Breuer, is my guest. She's just written a memoir called One Drop about learning his secret when she was 24 and how that secret changed her life. Her book also investigates her father's life and Creole heritage and reconstructs his family tree. In today's New York Times review, Janet Maslin wrote, "This fascinating, insightful book makes clear that Mr. Breuer left a legacy of racial confusion and great autobiographical material." Let's start with a reading from One Drop, describing how Bliss Breuer's mother revealed the secret.
"I think I better tell you what the secret is," my mother said. She was sitting between my brother Todd and me. We caught eyes behind her back. Inexplicably, we both began to grin. "Well," she took a breath and let it out, "your father's part black." I burst out with a laugh. "That's the secret? Daddy's part black? That's all?" Todd asked. "That's it," my mother said, allowing herself a smile. We asked a few questions. How black was he? After all, he didn't look black. Neither did his sister Lorraine or his mother, whom we'd seen once or twice when we were little. My mother explained that my father had mixed blood, and his parents were both light-skinned Creoles from New Orleans, where race mixing had been common. She said that his parents had to pass for white in order to get work in 1930s New York, which confused my father about what their family was or was supposed to be. He was the lightest child out of the three siblings, and the fact that his two sisters lived as black was one of the reasons that we never saw them. My mother said that when my father was growing up in Brooklyn, where his family had moved when he was six, he'd been ostracized by both white and black kids alike. The black kids picked on him because he looked white, and the white kids rejected him because they knew his family was black. He'd come home from school with his jacket torn, and his parents wouldn't ask what happened. My mother said that he didn't tell us about his racial background because he wanted to spare his own children from going through what he did. "So this means that we're part black, too," I said, taking in the news. I had always bought into the idea of the American melting pot, and now I was an example of it. The idea thrilled me, as though I'd been reading a fascinating history book and then discovered my own name in the index. I felt like I mattered in a way that I hadn't before. Todd was pleased, too. "What a great pickup line," he said. "I may look white, but I'm really Afro-American where it counts. The guys in my office are always giving me such a hard time about being so white-bred." "Todd," my mother said, alarmed, "this isn't something you should be telling everyone. Anyway, you kids aren't black. You're white."
And that's Bliss Breuer reading from her new memoir, One Drop. What a confusing message to give you. like your father has kept the secret all these years that he's really black, and but you're really white. Could it be more confusing?
No. Well, I think it was equally confusing for my dad because he'd grown up around people like himself who were Creoles from New Orleans, light-skinned blacks, and then when his family moved to New York, apparently his father had sat the kids down in the living room and said that from now on they had to be white in order to for them to work in New York, where it was very hard to get a job if you were black in the 1930s.
You knew that your father had a secret, but you didn't know what it was until your mother broke the news a couple of months before he died. He was in the hospital, he knew he was dying, and he didn't want to talk with you about it. He didn't want to reveal the secret himself. Why not?
Well, I think he always intended at some point during his illness to tell us, but I think it was very hard for him to figure out what the right words would be. And I think after keeping a secret from your children for, you know, all of our life, in a way it was more the fact of having a secret than the news itself that was going to be hard to explain. So he said, my mom had kind of sprung it on him a couple of months before that, you know, we're gathered here together, you're going to tell the kids the news. And he had said that he needed to think about how to present things. And I remember his phrasing because it was so typical and kind of surprising. He said he needed to He wanted to order his vulnerabilities so they didn't get magnified during the discussion. So I think that he had a lot to fear during this conversation, what we would think of him, whether it would change the way that we thought of ourselves, and, you know, that we'd be angry that we'd been kept from his family and this history for so long.
Were you angry?
I was angry. I mean, when I found out the actual news, I had just witnessed my father suffering terrible pain in the hospital. He'd been crying out, you know, help, like he was drowning. It was unbearable to listen to someone that you love suffer like that. So in that moment, I felt relief that the secret wasn't something more disturbing. Like, we thought perhaps he'd been the victim of some crime or there had been incest or something terrible. And so this seemed pretty lighthearted. By the time of his memorial service a month later, and that's where I met my father's sister, Shirley, and my cousin Frank, and saw his other sister, Lorraine, for the first time in 17 years, it started to dawn on me that this was more than just kind of an interesting note in his biography. And I did feel angry because as much as I wanted to reclaim that family and this history that I never knew, it was hard to start all of that at age 24.
Even though your father kept his racial identity a secret, a lot of his friends knew about it, even though his children didn't. And for years, there was speculation in the literary community about, was he really black passing for white? And your father was so well-known, not only because of his books, but because for years he was a literary critic for the New York Times. And so there was a lot of speculation, you know, was he passing because he was ashamed to be black? Was he passing because it would improve his life and his family's and the lives of his family members if he passed? Was he secretly racist? There was just all this speculation. So looking back now on your father's life, knowing what you know as a result of all the family history and genealogy that you did, what ideas do you have about how he felt about his racial identity as a black man, which he kept hidden?
My thoughts about why my father, or his feelings about his own racial identity, I think were very confusing for him. One of the indications I have of that is he'd filled out a Social Security application for a Social Security number when he was 17. It's the first record and one of the only records I have of him marking down his own race. And there's a check next to Negro, and then when that's crossed out, and then another check next to white, and then in the space other, there's a C, which could have stood for colored or Creole. So I think for him, it was an ongoing question about his own racial identity. I think that, you know, there's a fine line between kind of self-preservation. I think for him to live the life that he wanted, he didn't feel that he could do that as a black person. But then also selfishness, that he wanted to make up the rules, you know, as he went along and not have to live by these accepted society rules, the one drop rule, which said that he was a black person. So I think he did it for a lot of reasons, some to kind of protect himself and some to have the life that he wanted.
Your father in the 1940s was a bohemian, and he has a great memoir about his life in Greenwich Village in the 40s called Kafka Was the Rage. And, you know, it's all about, you know, like reinventing himself as his friends did too, and all of the kind of sexual adventures that he had and how important sex was to his life then. And, you know, even though he didn't reveal that he was, you know, black or Creole in the memoir, he revealed so many things about himself. And because, you know, like reinvention is so central to the whole idea of bohemian life then, where is that line, do you think, in his life between the reinvention that he thought everybody, the self-reinvention that he thought everybody should have a right to go through, and this kind of denial of who you really are?
I think that he probably fell more on the side of he thought everybody, like you say, had a right to self-invention. I mean, he wrote in Kafka Was the Rage that they all of his friends fled to Greenwich Village where, you know, nobody had a family. They were all sprung from their own brows and people's backgrounds. They were all trying to escape their backgrounds. And that was very much, you know, the moment in Greenwich Village after World War II when people were doing that. So I think for him, he you know, he really didn't feel like he had a responsibility, again, living in the way that sort of society had dictated to him, that he could live by his own rules.
One of his friends, Chandler Brassard, who'd also been living the bohemian life in Greenwich Village in the 1940s, later wrote a novel about that period. And one of the characters in the novel was based on your father, Anatole Broyard. And, you know, that character was a black man passing for white. The publisher sent your father a release form getting his permission for the character to be based on him, and your father was outraged. He refused to sign the form, so the character had to be changed as a result. And you say that your father felt betrayed, and that by singling out his racial identity, Chandler Brassard had made him an exception to the prevailing credo that they were all free to discover themselves without being encumbered by family or ancestral histories. And that in Chandler Brassard's formulation, your father wasn't inventing himself like everyone else. He was just pretending to be something that he wasn't.
Well, exactly. There was a kind of a special situation for blacks, that everyone else was invited in Greenwich Village, certainly, to take as much of their history and have that be as part of their lives as they wanted to. You know, I know people who were Jewish, but that wasn't from that era, but that wasn't particularly important about them, and it wasn't made to be important about them by their friends. And in my father's case, however, Brassard, in writing Who Walk in Darkness, seemed to suggest that, no, if you're black, you have a responsibility to be out. And my father greatly resented it and refused to sign the release. And as a result, Brassard had to change it. And he changed it to the main character was illegitimate, which, of course, didn't carry the same kind of social stigma in the 1940s as being black did.
You write that your father truly believed that there wasn't any essential difference between blacks and whites, and that the only person responsible for determining who he was supposed to be was himself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was very kind of easy for my father to feel that way because the world didn't see a black man when they looked at him. He wasn't reminded of it constantly, you know, in stores or in restaurants being refused service, which happened to a lot of his friends from the neighborhood who were darker skinned. So I think it was naive on his part to think that he could just a black person could reject all the kind of assumptions and stereotypes that white people often thought when seeing a black person. Brassard's kind of assumption that my father had to be black.
My guest is Bliss Broyard. Her new memoir is called One Drop. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bliss Broyard, and her new memoir, One Drop, is about her father, the literary critic and memoirist Anatole Broyard. And she found out when she was 24 that her father was really black, passing for white. And that's at the heart of this memoir. There were things that your father said that you quote in your memoir that make the reader wonder, you know, was your father perhaps racist? I mean, you describe how he was worried when black people started moving onto your block that they were going to bring down the price of your home. He sometimes used the word jigaboo. There are other instances like that you cite. Do you think that there was a racist aspect to your father or a self-hating aspect to your father?
Well, I think it was probably a little bit of both. I think that he felt angry at the existence of blacks. He sort of blamed them for the existence of racism rather than white people. And he, for example, the example that you cite about worrying about our house in Connecticut, you know, what he had seen happen in Bedford-Stuyvesant is when during the Depression, when a lot of blacks started moving into the neighborhood, the housing properties dropped. And so rather than seeing that as a really kind of a complicated societal problem, he just blamed blacks for bringing down the neighborhood. So I think it was both racism and self-hatred.
When you found out that your father was really a very light-skinned African-American, it meant that you not only had to revise your sense of your father's identity in his life, but of your own. And when your mother told you and your brother your father's secret, she said, "This isn't something you should be telling everyone. Anyway, you kids aren't black, you're white." So what do you think? Like, how do you define your racial identity when anybody asks you to, whether it's a forum or a conversation? How have you come to think of yourself racially?
Well, it sort of depends on the circumstance. Usually for a forum, I would say black, white, check all that apply, which we are now able to do since 2000. So in my case, it would be black, white, and Native American. In conversation, I used to really struggle over how to answer the question because I felt that if I said biracial or black, white, that there might be some expectation that I would seem more black in some way. I think I felt in the beginning that there was some kind of right answer out there, that I could put the circumstances in my life, you know, raised as a WASP for 23 years, learned this information at 24, met this many family members, knew this much about history, and come up with a succinct answer of my own identity. And it's a lot more complicated. You know, there isn't one right answer. So I think I'm sort of more interested in, I think that now that I've learned a lot about my history and met my family, I feel more comfortable with who I am and less concerned about how I represent myself. But the short answer would be, I say I have mixed race ancestry.
As you say, it was an open secret among people who knew your father well outside of his children, that he was black. But he was officially outed in a New Yorker article by Henry Louis Gates a few years ago. And Gates had actually had several long conversations with you, although you didn't know that he was writing or that he would eventually write a piece about your father when you talked with him about your father. What impact did Henry Louis Gates' article about your father have on you and your family?
Well, at first I was really upset about it, as he knows. I think I really had this idea that because I didn't have control over this information as a child, I wanted to take control over it by being the one who added my father. Now I'm really grateful that I didn't have to take on that responsibility. I think that, again, I had this idea that I could, you know, write a 1,000-word essay, or I somehow could come up with a statement that would encapsulate the struggle that he had over his racial identity and explain it. And I think it was very hard for me to do that. So I think that Gates kind of gave me something to respond to, and got the information out there. I mean, I told friends ever since I'd known, but the act of a kind of a public outing, I think, required a sort of drama that I'm glad I didn't end up getting engaged in.
Would you say that he got the story right?
I think that the Gates article was very perceptive about the notion of passing in general, and kind of questioning, you know, what is an authentic identity, and framing my dad's struggle in a lot of the modernist themes of reinvention. But I think that I would have liked to see more about my father's background as a Creole, because I think that that's the thing for me that was the missing piece that explained his separation, for example, in Bedford-Stuyvesant from the kind of larger black kids that were there. And they had always, his family, even within the black community, had kind of kept themselves separate. And I would have liked to see that in the piece as well.
Your memoir opens when your father is dying of prostate cancer that had metastasized. He wrote a great book about his final illness called Intoxicated by My Illness. He writes, "All my friends are wits, but now that I'm sick, I'm treated to the spectacle of watching them wear different faces. They come to see me, and instead of being ironical and making jokes, they're terribly serious. They look at me with a kind of grotesque lovingness in their faces. They touch me, they feel my pulse almost. They're trying to give me strength, and I'm trying to shove it off. The dying man has to decide how tactful he wants to be. What a critically ill person needs above all is to be understood." Were you self-conscious around him because he had this sense of what dying meant and how a dying person should behave and how his friends and family should behave. I'm not sure how much he actually communicated that. And I'm also not sure how self-conscious that would make you, that you had to behave according to his code. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's, yeah. I think that the moment that comes to mind is right before my father had this emergency surgery, my mother had called my brother and me and told us to come to the hospital. And she had to go off with some doctors to sign some forms, and she wanted me to stay in the room with him. And he was in a terrible crisis. He was in a lot of pain. He looked like he was in shock. And I thought that I was probably never going to see him again. That's what the doctors had kind of led us to expect after the surgery. He wouldn't necessarily make it. And so I tried to say goodbye. And he kind of kept looking at me, and I pulled my chair closer and was whispering, you know, the things that you say to someone if you think they're dying, that I loved him, that I was proud of him, that he had lived a good life. And he told me to stop with my bromides, that this was incredibly difficult and that he needed to concentrate. And it's funny to me because he wrote a wonderful story about his own father's death, what the cystoscope said, where, you know, he sat at his father's bedside and said a lot of those same things, and it's a very beautiful and moving scene. So I think that my father did welcome those sentiments, but the articulation of them, perhaps because, you know, they do come out in kind of cliched language, you know, embarrassed him or troubled him.
Well, Bliss Broyard, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Bliss Broyard's new memoir is called One Drop. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Husbandry, Sex, Love, and Dirty Laundry, Inside the Minds of Married Men by Stephen Fried. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for a college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. And from TIAA CREF, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the first large-scale operation by an international jihadi movement in modern times. We talk with journalist Yaroslav Trofimov about the 1979 siege of Mecca by hundreds of gunmen on what was the first morning of the new Muslim century. It's the subject of his new book. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear the story of a forgotten crisis in the early days of the modern global jihadi movement. On November 20th, 1979, which was the first day of the new century on the Islamic calendar, Islamic extremists took over the Grand Mosque of Mecca in the hopes of starting a global war that would lead to Islam's total victory. My guest, journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, has written a new book about the crisis called The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda. He says the story isn't well known for a couple of reasons. The House of Saud did its best to prevent news of the siege from getting out, and the Carter administration didn't realize the significance of the siege, in part because it was so focused on the Iranian hostage crisis. Trofimov has been a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal since 1999 and has reported extensively from Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. Yaroslav Trofimov, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we really get into the story, where do you see the story fitting in the rise of radical Islam?
I think this was really the beginning of the modern jihadi radical violent movement that led to Al-Qaeda. If you look at the history of this radical movement, the very first operation that was transnational, that involved terrorists from several countries, Saudi Arabia, the United States, Egypt, was really this one, the 1979 takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. This is really where it all began.
Well, let's get to the story. Why did this group of radical Islamists take over the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979? What were their grievances?
Well, they really believe that the, first of all, Saudi Arabia has strayed from the path of true Islam. They objected to things like the presence of Western embassies, the presence of Westerners as such in the kingdom, the alliance with the United States, and even trivial things like the fact that pictures were being used on currency, the portraits were hanging on the walls of offices, even though the in their view of Islam, Islamic scriptures prohibit any graven images. So going from that, they hoped and they believed that by taking over the Grand Mosque, they would start the worldwide movement to purify Islam and to eventually triumph in the entire world. The ideology was quite messianic. They believed that one of them was going to be the Mahdi, the new redeemer. And the day was not accidental. This was the very first dawn of the 14th century of the Islamic calendar, which, according to some prophecies, is the time when the redeemer would come.
So did the people who took over the Grand Mosque in Mecca believe that the end of the world was imminent?
Some of them did. The Saudis definitely believed that. Many of the Egyptians and other foreign radicals who joined them were more opportunistic. They didn't necessarily share the messianic beliefs, but they thought that this would be the spark that would start the worldwide uprising because of the huge symbolism of the place. This is the holiest place in Islam. Every Muslim, every day, five times a day, must pray facing towards the Grand Mosque. Even in death, Muslims are buried with their faces towards the Grand Mosque. And that very morning, there were more than 100,000 pilgrims from the world over in that mosque.
Tell us about the leader of the siege, Juhayman al-Utaybi. Who was he?
Well, Juhayman al-Utaybi's history is very interesting. His father was very active in the uprising by the radical Islamist Bedouin tribes against the House of Saud in the 1920s. That was an uprising against the government's decision to open up to the West, to establish relations with Western countries, and to bring in some such devilish innovations as cars and radio and telegraphs. So he had this history of family resentment against the monarchy. He joined the Saudi National Guard. He was a corporal there. But then he started studying the Islamic religion in the university in Medina, which was one of the new universities established by King Faisal in the 1960s and 70s, where many of the teachers and the professors were Islamic radicals from Egypt and Syria and other places who brought the ideology that had been developed by the Muslim Brotherhood and by other outfits to Saudi Arabia. So this blend of the traditional Bedouin zeal and the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood was what really fueled him. And he became, he was a very charismatic figure. And so instantly he gained following from many, many younger students who saw him as sort of a guru.
So he was radicalized at the university?
He was opposed to the regime since his childhood, but he really got into the Islamic theology and became involved with the Islamic movement at the university in Medina. And the head of the university at the time was Sheikh bin Baz, who would in the future become the supreme religious authority of Saudi Arabia, the Grand Mufti, and who was very sympathetic initially to this movement.
Now, the people who took over the mosque smuggled their guns in coffins. Coffins? Wouldn't coffins look suspicious in the mosque?
Well, coffins are not suspicious at all because by Muslim tradition, if you want to bestow the blessings on your departed relatives and to ensure that they are well off in paradise, you have to bring the body to the Grand Mosque and have the Imam bless it. Oh. So always, especially at the end of the Hajj season, you could see at the time hundreds of people bringing their relatives, sometimes all the way from India or from Iraq, to the holiest shrine that a Muslim can ever visit.
Since this is the holiest shrine in Islam, isn't it disrespectful to bring in guns and use them?
Well, certainly it's disrespectful and very unusual. It is really the very first time that guns were used inside the mosque. And in the Muslim tradition, you cannot even hurt a bird in that sacred precinct, let alone discharge a gun. So this was why there was really no defense organized against such an intrusion. The guards in the mosque were only armed with sticks to beat up some misbehaving pilgrims. They didn't have any guns or ammunition themselves.
So paint pictures for us of how the siege started, how they got in, and what they did once they got into the Holy Mosque.
Well, once they smuggled in the weapons, and they didn't just smuggle them in the coffins, but they also had bribed some guards of the Bin Laden company that was doing construction work in the mosque and had driven 3 truckloads of ammunition into the basement. So once they've done that, Juhayman al-Rutaybi and his gunmen marched to the very center of the enclosure during the dawn prayers. He pushed away the imam of the mosque, who had been his teacher before, and announced that the mosque has been taken over. His gunmen fired in the air. The plan was very well organized, so they raced towards the almost 50 gates of this enormous sort of stadium-sized enclosure and locked these 100,000 pilgrims inside. Then they went up the minarets. There were 7 minarets in the Grand Mosque at the time, and they were the tallest structure in the city of Mecca. And they established sniper nests at the very top of these minarets. And from there, they could keep the entire city in the field of fire and very effectively repel future attacks by the Saudi forces.
What about the thousands and thousands of people who'd come to pray at the Holy Mosque? What happened to them?
Initially, Juhayman al-Rutaybi and his followers read out their manifesto, explained what they wanted to do. And the Grand Mosque at the time, and still today, had the very powerful radio system that would broadcast the 5 daily prayers throughout the entire city. So the entire city could hear what they wanted to do. So once they've done that, he presented his brother-in-law, whom he believed was the Messiah, and made everybody in the mosque pledge allegiance to him. Once that happened, the Saudis, especially the Saudis among the pilgrims, those who looked more religious, who had long bushy beards, were told to stay and help defend the mosque against the infidel onslaught of the regime. The foreigners were allowed to escape through a few windows in the basement. And slowly over the next few days, they trickled out because obviously Juhayman didn't have water or food to keep such a large number of hostages inside.
My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. He's a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He covers Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda. After the siege, you know, the king wanted to end the siege as quickly as possible, which was going to prove very difficult to do. One of the things the king did was meet with the highest clergy, the ulema, and try to work out a fatwa with them. Why did he need a fatwa from them, and what kind of compromise did he have to work out?
He needed fatwa from the senior clergy because many soldiers refused to fight, again because of this Islamic prohibition on using weapons in the shrine. They would just wouldn't point their guns towards the Grand Mosque in the very first days of the of this tragedy. And also, many of them believed what they had heard. They believed that the Messiah had come. This was, as foretold in the prophecy, the very first day of the new century. And so they really needed convincing by the religious authorities that following the orders was something legitimate, that they would not go to hell, literally, if they executed the commands of the military. So once the king realized that he had such a problem, he summoned the top leaders of the clergy to his palace in Riyadh. And they had a very long discussion there, because first of all, the clerics had to look at the facts and figure out whether indeed the Messiah had arrived. Many of them knew Juhayman al-Rutaybi and they knew his followers, if only because just a year earlier, many of them had been arrested on sedition charges, and the top clerics had personally intervened with the Saudi government, asking for their release. So they knew who they were dealing with. And a big compromise was struck at the time. The top clerics said, yes, we will let you go and recapture the mosque, but in exchange, you must stop this slide towards secularism and modernization that was occurring in Saudi Arabia at the time. Back then, women could be seen narrating the news on television. And in some places, they were even driving. So that grand bargain was struck. And in exchange for the religious endorsement of the storming of the Grand Mosque, the Saudi government did roll back many of the religious freedoms in the following years. And also, they channeled billions and billions of dollars in their oil revenues towards the clerical establishment so they could spread their ideology all over the Muslim world. And the direct result of this is the emergence of Al-Qaeda later, because many of Al-Qaeda's recruits in places like Pakistan, like the Balkans, like Indonesia, or like Bangladesh, did go to these Saudi-funded academies that sprang up as a direct result of the siege of Mecca.
How did the rules of engagement change once the Saudi king got the fatwa from the top clerics of Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi government is pretty much reckless as far as human casualties go. You know, when the commanders were complaining about almost suicidal missions in which they were being sent, Prince Nayef, the interior minister, would say, "You know, they will become martyrs and go to paradise, and everybody will envy them. So let them die." So the biggest care that they took in the first days was not to damage the actual shrine, because the government knew that if the shrine is damaged, securing clerical approval for the operation will be much more difficult. But once they had this fatwa in hand, once it was broadcast, then they started using heavy force. They used artillery, they used armored personnel carriers, they used aviation, and a large part of the structure was destroyed.
Large part of the mosque?
Well, the mosque itself is very big. In the center of it stands the Kaaba, which is really the holy site, the building that supposedly was built by the biblical Ibrahim many millennia ago. But after that, around it, there is a courtyard. And encircling the courtyard is the actual mosque. So that mosque was built fairly recently, and most of the structures there were erected in the 20th century and built by the Bin Laden family.
Yeah, talk about paradoxes there. Like the Bin Laden family builds the mosque. Part of the mosque is destroyed during the siege, and the siege kind of, the way you describe it, leads in part to the start of Al-Qaeda and to the radicalization of young Bin Laden, of Osama Bin Laden.
Well, Osama Bin Laden was very impressed and very deeply troubled by what he saw happening in Mecca. You know, he was living at the time in Jeddah, just 1 hour's driving away. And his brother, who at the time ran the company, was involved in the effort. He was cloistered with the senior princes, helping them storm the mosque, because he was the only one who had the blueprints of the basement and of the structure, because his company had built much of it. And Osama bin Laden in the following years repeatedly said that this was the moment of truth for him. And he empathized more with Juhayman and the rebels than with the Saudi government, whom he accused of desecrating the mosque by sending threaded vehicles and using artillery in such a holy site.
But why? It's just so confusing to me why he would identify with the radicals who brought guns into the holy site in the first place. I mean, that seems like a desecration.
Well, he viewed them as idealists who only brought guns to defend themselves. And when Juhayman was explaining the operation to his co-conspirators, that was what he was saying. We only need guns if we are attacked. We are in the right. God is with us. And many Islamists who were upset by what had happened there would have preferred for the government just to wait it out and wait until the water and the food had finished in the mosque instead of storming it so violently.
What kind of help did the Saudis ask the United States for during the siege of Mecca?
Well, the Americans were involved on many levels in the tragedy in Mecca. First of all, a few of the co-conspirators of the members of Juhayman's terrorist group were African-American converts to Islam who had been brainwashed while studying in Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, the Saudi Arabian government did not have enough pilots of its own, so it had to use Americans who were working in the kingdom to fly a combat mission in helicopters above the mosque. More formally, the government had asked for some advice from the CIA, which had a long-standing program to train and equip Saudi internal security forces. But one must remember, this was a time when the CIA's reputation was at a pretty low level in the world. It was just a few years after the congressional hearings. And so Prince Turki, who was at the time the head of the Saudi intelligence, didn't put much stock in what the CIA could do for him. So instead, he ended up turning to the French intelligence. And interestingly, at that time, the French, unlike now, were the interventionist hardcore power that believed in using military force to oust unfriendly regimes, whereas the Carter administration was seen as sort of in retreat and abhorring any use of force anywhere in the world. Sort of an interesting reversal of the roles today.
So it was French commandos who helped the Saudis end the siege of Mecca.
The French role was very important. The French government had dispatched its elite team called GIGN, which was probably at the time the best commando force in Europe, if not in the world. They had trained Delta forces later on. And this small unit had brought with them a large amount of poison gas and training materials. And they set up shop not far from Mecca in the city of Taif. And they trained and planned the operation to flush out the rebels from the basement of the mosque once the surface had been recaptured. Because the basement really was the most difficult part. It's a network of about 1,000 rooms, all different levels with narrow corridors where tanks or threat vehicles could not be used. And so they devised a plan to perforate the ceiling of the basement and to fire down large amounts of poison gas that killed or knocked out most of the rebels and allowed the stormtroops to jump down and to reoccupy the basement.
And then after the siege was ended, all the radicals who were captured ended up being beheaded.
All the adult rebels who were captured in the mosque in December 1979 were either beheaded in public in several Saudi cities in January 1980 or were killed in secret in custody in the following month. So the only survivors who know what actually went on during the siege from within are people who were 15, 16, 14 years at the time. They were giving long prison sentences, but they're still alive today. And part of the book is based on my interviews with them on their testimonies of what they had witnessed at the time.
Now, in your book, you make it seem like the siege of Mecca was really a turning point in radical Islam and the start of, you know, like the prequel to Al-Qaeda.
Exactly.
The Carter administration was in power in 1979 during the siege, and the siege happened at the start of the third week of the Iranian hostage crisis, which was capturing the attention of the Carter administration and of a lot of America at the time. Did the Carter administration see the siege of Mecca as being significant and as having large implications for the future of the United States?
If one reads American documents from that time, the documents from the State Department, from the CIA, or from within the White House, it almost looks like a comedy of errors, because initially, once the siege started, the working assumption in Washington was that the Iranians had done it. And once the news broke, and the news broke in Washington for the first time, this was the message given out by the administration. The Iranians had occupied the Grand Mosque. The Iranians want to overthrow Al Saud. And obviously the Iranians are very unhappy to hear that. So the next day they turn around and accuse the Americans and the Zionists. And this led to terrible violence in the following days and the burning of the American embassy in Pakistan. But later on, once the siege ended, I looked at the CIA reporting, and their conclusion was, oh, this is a one-off event. This is just a throwback to the distant past. Radical Islam is not at all a danger in the future. So really, the administration blinked on this one and missed the significance of it. And one must remember also that this wasn't just happening as the Iranian hostage crisis was unfolding. This was happening a few weeks, 2-3 weeks before the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. And once that invasion happened, all of a sudden, all these radical Islamists were seen as a useful resource that could be thrown against the Soviets in Afghanistan, which is what happened in following years.
My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov. His new book is called The Siege of Mecca. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His new book, The Siege of Mecca, is about the crisis in 1979 when Islamic extremists took over the Grand Mosque of Mecca. Trofimov describes it as the start of the modern global jihadi movement. Your book is filled with a lot of historically interesting information, and part of that interesting history had to do with how the Saudis, earlier... the Saudis, like before this 1979 siege, had welcomed a lot of jihadis and Islamists to Saudi Arabia because they felt they had something in common. These Islamists opposed the secular governments of Egypt and other countries. Saudi Arabia had a religious government, so it was different. Egypt and other countries earlier in the century had advocated pan-Arabism. This kind of like, a one-state kind of thing based on Arab identity. The Saudis didn't want that. They wanted a religious state. And they felt this connection to the Islamic radicals, but that connection ended up backfiring on them.
Well, absolutely. They were blindsided by what had happened because traditionally Saudi Arabia saw itself as the guardian of Islam, and its prestige and its security was laid on the fact that they could claim that we are the most Islamic country in the world. Therefore, we can lead the Muslim world. It doesn't matter that we are a relatively small country in terms of population, that our culture doesn't go as deep as the culture in Egypt or in Syria and other traditional centers of the Arab world. But by the virtue of being the most Islamic state in the world at the time, they felt pretty safe. And suddenly somebody from within challenges that and says, well, you're not Islamic enough for us. We want to go further. And you really are infidels. So that was a big shock to the House of Saud. And they tried to cope with this in following years by buying off that more radical movement and by channeling its energies outside of Saudi Arabia through this network of missionary activities and schools and charities.
So they bought off the radicals by funding their schools and other activities, which would you say that continued to backfire against the powers that be in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it certainly took the attention of the radical movement away from Saudi Arabia for a decade or two, but it did backfire in recent years because that is one of the factors that led to the creation of Al-Qaeda, which has been attacking within Saudi Arabia again in the last few years, bombing hotels and bombing housing complexes and military installations. So that is a threat that in a way was bred by the government itself.
So you've told the story of a not a very well-known chapter in the history of radical Islam. How would you like this story to change the way we see that history?
Well, first of all, this really shows the power of this radical ideology and how it's a fairly small group of people, but powered by the zeal and the beliefs, could stave off the entire Saudi army and for 2 weeks in the most sensitive place in the world. And the other lesson is that just how badly it was misjudged by the West. The West blinked at the time. They didn't realize what was going on and didn't realize the consequences of what had happened for another 20-plus years.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Yaroslav Trofimov is the author of the new book, The Siege of Mecca. He's a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Knocked Up, the hit comedy about a slacker who becomes a father after a one-night stand, is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the film's writer and director, Judd Apatow, and its star, Seth Rogen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.